Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Allison Stewart today. My next guest has been a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry and has received fellowships from the Fulbright, Guggenheim, and MacArthur Foundations. Ben Lerner's most recent book is the final installment of a trilogy that began back in 2011 with his debut novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, in which we follow the main character, Adam, through his time pursuing a Fulbright in Spain. This was followed in 2014 by the book 1004, which continues to chart Adam's career as a writer. Now, this third and last installment can be thought of as a kind of prequel that illuminates Adam's early days in Topeka, Kansas, in the 90s, being raised by two therapists. And as with all of the books in the trilogy, this novel, The Topeka School, tracks closely with the author's real-life experiences. He joins me now in the studio, Ben Lerner. Hi, welcome to All of It.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, Ben, you really did grow up in Topeka, Kansas.
I did.
You were in high school in the 90s. And like your character Adam, you really were raised by two psychologists, including the well-known psychologist and writer Dr. Harriet Lerner, your mother. So a lot of this book is about this mother-son relationship. So we'll start with this big idea. We'll keep whittling down. Why did you want to go back in time with this third novel and talk about young Adam and his mother during these formative years?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the personal level, when I became a parent, I suddenly had kind of like new imaginative access to my parents. Like I got interested in writing a book that was in part about remembering my own childhood from the perspective of my parents. And there are kind of two Adams in this book. There's like the Adam who's an adolescent in high school and even a younger Adam in some of his parents' memories. And then there's kind of the older, often just implied Adam who's remembering Topeka in the 90s while the parent of two young girls in Brooklyn. So I think there was this way when I became a parent, I suddenly felt like I could write the prequel to the other two novels because I was, you know, when you become a parent, you're both in your present and you're also suddenly remembering your childhood with new vividness. So it's a kind of time travel. So that was part of it personally. And then I think just with the kind of trilogy, the books in mind, I wanted to kind of, you know, this book is about, the Topeka School is really about prehistory in a certain way, like the way patterns recur across generations or the prehistory of our political present. And I got interested in writing a book that could both be the final term in a sequence, but also the kind of prehistory or unconscious of the other two books.
And how much were you drawing from your own real lived experiences? How much is Adam and Ben the same person?
A lot. I mean, enough that sometimes I get confused about what's real and what's fictional. I mean, I always, you know, each novel has kind of been about, to a certain degree, the way that we live according to fictions, like the stories we tell about ourselves determine our experience and are also subject to change, which can be like a vertiginous problem. Your identity can collapse or it can be a possibility. You can redefine yourself. So the first novel was kind of Adam being abroad, telling all these ridiculous lies in this moment of possible reinvention. And the second novel, Adam is kind of, or the narrator is kind of interested in, you know, how to tell new stories about the future that can make the present feel alive. And this book is in part about kind of family history and storytelling across the generations and the way a voice is formed out of all these different influences that precede it. And so for me, kind of using autobiographical material seemed thematically relevant. It's not that I'm kind of in general committed to this idea that fiction should be about an avatar, but I did feel like because of the themes I was concerned with, that kind of developed naturally.
And also unusual to this book is the shifting of narrative, right? And whose perspective we're hearing the story from. Can you talk a bit about how you got into the voice of your mother?
Yeah.
Did you actually sit down with your own mother for those parts?
Well, I did and I didn't. I mean, I'm very close with my mom. She's a great writer. She's a great editor of my work. So I'm always, to a certain degree, sitting down with her and talking about what I'm writing. This book was in part written in conversation with her, but there is a section that's really written in a kind of version of her voice. Mm-hmm. But that conversation never took place. That conversation was fictional. But then we discussed that fictional conversation, so it made kind of contact with the real. I mean, you're right. This book is really different narratively. Like the other two novels are in the first person. And in this book, I got interested and still using some biographical materials, but really like throwing the voice, really trying to imagine the voices of the generation that preceded me. But there's a way in which when you try to really intensely imagine versions of your parents' voices, you're still kind of interrogating the prehistory of your own voice. So you're still kind of thinking about the formation of your voice even when you're really intensely trying to imagine these other voices that were influential. But I definitely wanted to kind of, you know, I don't, when you're a writer, you don't want to repeat yourself. So I did want to do something that was kind of in the context of the other two books, but like maximally different within the sequence. Mm. And the other two novels are so in the head of the narrator that I wanted to see what would happen if I wrote about the character who was most like me in the third person, and if I tried to really access the minds of the parents and some other characters in this book.
Now, talking about language and speech and intentionality of it, that's a major theme in this novel. And very early on, we learn that Adam is a debate team kid. And you, Ben, were also very much a debate team kid. In fact, you were kind of a debate champ, right? Can you talk about why you chose to write about this very particular microcosm of, for some people, their high school experience?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, this, you know, Adam Gordon is kind of torn between these two different worlds of language because his parents are psychologists, like you mentioned. They're a talky Jewish family. His parents are from the coast. His mom's from Brooklyn. But he's being raised in this very like red state where to talk, especially if you're a guy, is considered kind of emasculating. So it's kind of about him trying to navigate these two very different regimes of language. Mm-hmm. And debate in the book becomes both something he's like really embarrassed about because it's too nerdy, but also kind of this like weaponization of eloquence becomes the way that he can kind of pass as a tough guy through linguistic combat. There's also this phenomena about high school debate. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard this thing in high school debate called the spread.
I actually have a clip of the spread because I wanted our listeners to hear it. Of course, you describe it so beautifully in the book. The description's incredible, but there's something very, very visceral.
Yeah, you have to hear it.
About hearing it. So let's hear it just for an example, a few competitive Dartmouth debaters speaking.
Our critique of military presence and discourse stability is a crucial contribution to decolonizing international
repressed race, nobles, and militarization with state enemies, domination, and legitimate global win.
Presence in Africa, our decolonial ethic exposes the fallacy of American ethical intervention. Now, the U.S.
nation will not be caused to men.
Attention to the compound demonic process.
Instead of absolute revolution, war process.
Okay, got all that? Ben, I feel like I'm actually drowning just listening to that.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
So that is what's called the spread.
That's what's called the spread. And what's happening is that they're trying to make more arguments in the allotted time than the other team can respond to. With the idea just being that if you don't manage to respond to one of those arguments, you concede it. That's kind of like the rule. And I got really interested in this reduction of what was like nominally an exchange of ideas to this weird like glossolalia ritual. I mean, that was actually relatively tame, that clip. Uh-huh. I mean, there's like a lot of like spitting and sweating and like barking like seals, gasping for breath or whatever.
Wait, I don't want to gloss over that term you just used, glossolalia.
Yeah.
It's like a word salad.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, like glossolalia. In a religious sense, glossolalia is like speaking in tongues, you know, and can be about like divine transport. But this was a kind of emptying out of language that kind of sounds like this new idiom, but it's really like kind of the language of contemporary, you know, policy. Like you can be debating healthcare or juvenile crime policy or whatever, but you're really like reducing it to this athletic spectacle. And in the book, I kind of am interested in the spread both as a metaphor for like the collapse of our political speech, you know, like although our politicians speak really, really slowly, like one thing that Trump has learned, for example, is that to have like one scandal would be a problem. But if you have like 5,000 scandals a day, it's overwhelming and incapacitating. So it's kind of a metaphor for the collapse of public speech in our present. But then I also kind of got interested in this like weird glimmer of possibility in the spread, like that sometimes Adam, the character, when he participates in this activity, starts to feel, and this is where glossolalia kind of takes on its other meaning, starts to feel like language, just the social miracle of language, is moving through him. Like he's not delivering a speech, but a speech is delivering him. And it's this kind of glimmer of like poetic possibility that the book also thinks of as a kind of like almost avant-garde poetry. So, you know, it's easy just to be like freaked out by the spread and these weird extreme linguistic theaters. But the book also wants to like look for little glimmers of hope kind of mixed into the madness.
My guest is the writer Ben Lerner. We're talking about the latest in his book, his trilogy. The novel is called The Topeka School. Ben, there's another way that these ideas sort of manifest themselves in the story, which is we see Adam and his affinity for debate also manifest itself in another way that has a lot of social currency, especially for a teenage boy, which is to say Adam can really hold his own in a freestyle rap battle.
That's right.
Again, Ben, you are mining your own life here. Tell us about your freestyle rapping days in high school.
Oh, man. What I can tell you is that I'm really grateful that there weren't smartphones.
We don't have a clip of that,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Thank goodness. Yeah, I mean, the book is kind of ruthless about depicting the ridiculousness and very American practice of these white middle-class kids appropriating these spectacularized images of African-American violence. But again, like, it both wants to kind of mock them, you know, these kids in tract houses who are reciting inapplicable cliches that they've learned from gangster rap videos. But again, it also wants to observe two things. Like, one is just like, what great luck for Adam that, you know, on Fridays he's at these debate tournaments or practicing this extemporaneous speaking, and then the cool kids are having these parties on Saturdays where the fact that he can like use his linguistic gifts to be cool, just that there's this like ritualized poetic insult exchange available for him because he can like thrive in that context, however embarrassing. But the other thing is that the book, again, like, for it's a totally busted, politically compromised form, but it is a place where Adam has an experience of flow. And an experience of flow, like when you have this sense of language is bigger than you, like you're not just making decisions consciously, you're kind of being used by the language is speaking through you. That's a moment again of like poetry and possibility. And what the book wants to kind of say is that, you know, even in these bankrupt linguistic forms, when you confront, when you have that experience of flow, it returns you to just the mundane miracle of language as such. Like, here we are talking where we're like, you know, using our bodies to make columns of air vibrate, and suddenly there's language and we can, you know, have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, the book wants to make contact with that basic kind of incredible fact within these very embarrassing and extreme practices.
Yeah, and the very cool extreme of being able to hold your own in a freestyle rap battle versus the very perceived nerdish application in a debate team. I know that these are ideas that you've been thinking about for a long time. In fact, there was an essay in 2012 published in Harper's, right, where you were sort of, it was the early version of what would become this book.
That's
talking
right.
about debate as a high schooler in Topeka. What made you want to write about speech and language in this way? And I'm especially curious because, knowing that this was a seed planted so much earlier for you, how you've seen your ideas about this shift over the course of this presidency.
Yeah.
And now even as we are entering the campaigning.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always wanted to write the Topeka book for a certain degree, but I think I didn't know how to do it until that thing happened that I was talking about, where I kind of became a parent and realized the key was to write it from the parent's perspective and not just from the adolescent's perspective. That was a kind of formal solution, but as you imply, like, it also felt writable and important to write because we are at a moment of like total fascist regression in speech, you know, where the kind of valorized stupidity of Trump speak, which is just this kind of mashup of racist, contentless dog whistling. I mean, its only content is this kind of tribal signaling, made me feel like a book, thinking through the genealogy of my own speech was like personally important, and that a book thinking about kind of the prehistory of a certain kind of like, again, like bankruptcy of political rhetoric was really important. And also to think about the vacuity at the heart of white masculinity that gets filled with xenophobia, misogyny, and other forms of hate. I mean, it wasn't like I delighted in the prospect of writing that book, but it felt like the kind of only book I could write within the present. And to not just write a book, you know, that was kind of about Trump, but to think about that kind of regression in speech, that kind of emptying out of speech and that dog whistling as something that has, you know, a rhythm and a history in America and beyond America. For example, Klaus, who's this analyst, you know, a Holocaust survivor who's at the foundation, who's kind of an important figure for Adam's parents, is kind of there in the book in part to say, you know, we've seen versions of this before, not to equate, you know, 2019 and 1939 or whatever, but to say like the debasement of a language, especially in terms of kind of like the racist villainization of others and this kind of delight in the possibilities of unreason, is a really dangerous moment. And I wanted not just to critique it, but to also pay attention to the way that's inside me, you know, like that those languages are part of my formation and what are the kinds of languages I have to unlearn, especially from the perspective of a parent who's necessarily, you know, participating in intergenerational transmission with his own kids.
Mm. I'm speaking with the writer Ben Lerner. We're talking about his most recent book, The Topeka School. Ben, throughout this book, there is an acknowledgement of a lot of these ideas you were just speaking about, like hate and anger, and not just any kind of anger, but white male rage in particular. The sort of long simmering, sometimes violent rage of the teenage boys in Topeka that you write about, and also the anger that the mother in the book and your mother in real life, I understand, weathered from men.
Yeah.
Largely because of her work as a psychologist writing about women and women's anger, for that matter. What were you wanting to express about who male anger hurts?
Yeah.
And the systems that it can impact?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think a lot about that. There's this old Baldwin essay that talks about the lie of whiteness, and it's one of the things that makes the essay really interesting is its focus is not just on the horrible crimes, you know, wreaked by white supremacy on people of color across the world. It's also about how it's a kind of cancer for the racist, right? That in the process of defining yourself according to a racist ideology, you kind of surrender the power to have any other positive vocabulary of meaning. And one of the things I was interested in were these boys and men in the 90s, when there was this discourse of the end of history, like supposedly with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and, you know, the end of the Soviet Union and the baby boomer Clinton trounces Bob Dole, like it was supposed to be like a kind of triumph. This was a white fantasy, obviously, a kind of triumph for a kind of white middle class, whatever. And I wanted to remember the 90s from the vantage of the present and say, actually, like precisely at that moment when, you know, supposedly the privileged subjects of the American empire should have been taking their victory lap or whatever, we actually got things like, you know, Columbine. Like we started to get these crimes of unreason, almost dispassion, not crimes of passion. These crimes of a kind of cultural poverty at the heart of whiteness, and that vacuum gets filled with violence, misogyny, xenophobia, et cetera. So the book really is, you know, it's not a work of political science, but it wants to kind of get at that idea that, you know, that whiteness is a bad fiction. And it's bad, obviously. It's catastrophic for the things it does to the you know, the people who are defined as non-white. But it's also not good for white people, obviously. It leads to this kind of nihilistic hunger for some other to demote. And the book wanted to take that really seriously. And it also wanted to think about, you know, the fragility of masculinity that many people are talking about now, you know, like the way Trump is always saying, like, so-and-so is not nice to me, it's sad, you know, that the kind of weakness, the inability of masculinity to be challenged in this way, where, like, so when Jane writes a book that basically says, like my mom's own book, you know, that if women are angry in their relationships, it might mean that something needs to change, as opposed to them just being hysterical or whatever, like she starts to get all these calls from men who are threatening her and feel she's a homewrecker, etc.
And this happens in the book, but it also happened in real life.
That's right. That part is pretty much based on real life, and the young Adam is kind of witnessing this, you know. And so I guess I mean to say, like, the book is, you know, it's a family with a lot of strengths. It's a town that has a lot of interesting things about it, but it's also a place where the privileged subjects of the American empire are very lost. And that identity crisis is dangerous. It's dangerous because we need some vocabulary of love and collectivity that can be other to that racist ideology that kind of runs in, you know, to fill the vacuum.
I've been speaking with Ben Lerner about his new novel, The Topeka School. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. I enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll take a deep dive into the salacious story of the National Enquirer, told from the perspectives of former editors and reporters, along with Mark Landsman, director of the new documentary. It's called Scandalous, The True Story of the National Enquirer. Much more after this break. Stay with us.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.